You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm books editor Karen Shook, and I'm very honoured today to have as our guest in studio Richard J. Evans, Regius Professor of Modern History and President of Wolfson College at the University of Cambridge. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Hi, nice to be here.
Now, I've lured you into our clutches, obviously, because you have a new book out, Altered Pasts, Counterfactuals in History. This is published by Little Brown, and it's out on the 27th of March. This book came about rather speedily, I'm given to understand.
Yes. Well, yes and no, really. I was asked a couple of years ago, about 18 months in advance, to give a series of lectures in Jerusalem by the Historical Society of Israel, which is a very old institution going back way before the State of Israel. And they've had these lectures delivered by extremely eminent historians from many different countries in the past. So I was very honoured to accept the invitation. And they wanted it to be on a theoretical or methodological aspect of history, which I think reflects the rather German character of the traditional academic world in Israel. Mm-hmm. And so I'd been thinking for a long time since the late 90s about counterfactuals, that's to say, the kind of imaginary history that posits a single small change in the timeline. Let's say the Archduke Franz Ferdinand is not assassinated, or Napoleon wins the Battle of Waterloo, and then extrapolates from that a whole series of other consequences. And I was originally alerted to this in 1998 when I did a TV program called Robin Day's Book Talk with Neil Ferguson and Antonia Fraser. And Neil Ferguson had just brought out a pioneering collection of essays about counterfactuals. And I'd just written a book called In Defense of History. So I got really interested in the subject, so I decided to give the lectures on counterfactuals. And so I prepared, I got together a lot of books and a lot of material, and I, of course, inevitably arrived in Jerusalem only having half finished the lectures. But fortunately, the weather was really bad, and so I sat in the very nice premises that they gave me and kind of worked away at it over a couple of weeks and then finished it off when I got back.
So the counterfactual version of this would have been incredible sunshine in Israel and no book.
A book would have taken a lot longer to do, I think.
Now, the idea of counterfactual history, the what-ifs, surely is not new. Pascal, famously, if Cleopatra's nose had been shorter, the whole face of the world would have changed. It's not something that's happened recently, It does sound to me like history essays. Are these the sorts of things that used to be in the Oxbridge exams? Had the Battle of Actium gone the other way, please say what would have resulted?
I don't remember those for my Oxford exams.
Okay, well, I'm guessing. I never took one.
On the real thing. Yes, it's always puzzled me, Pascal's thought, that if Cleopatra had had a small nose, Mark Antony would not have fallen in love with her, and so he would not have dallied instead of getting ready, and so he would have defeated Octavian, and so the Roman Empire would not have been founded. It puzzled me because Pascal obviously thought women with big noses were extremely sexy, and
they were the real thing.
Always kind of puzzled me. But yeah, there have been kind of sporadic, occasional thoughts like that. I mean, even Livy, the Roman historian, speculated about what might have happened had Alexander the Great conquered Rome. But they're always isolated, and they're always just one or two sentences, particularly in the Middle Ages up to the 18th century, because if you believe in providential history, if you believe God is...
And God wanted it that way, so it would be...
Then it's impious to consider alternatives. So you needed a rationalistic view of history. And you also needed the Rankean 19th century view of history is divided into sharply distinct epochs, each with its own characteristics, which makes the contemplation of change much more exciting and much more interesting, I think. So the first speculations are really 19th century. But even so, these speculations are kind of isolated, and mostly they're not very serious. Right. So they're meant to entertainment. So there's a collection.
A parlor game, sort of.
It's like a parlor game. Yeah. You know, so they're short essays. There's a collection edited by Sir John Squire, who was a famously frivolous English literature specialist in the 30s, and then there's another editor by the American historian John Merriman in the 70s. But it's not until the mid-90s that suddenly you get an enormous outpouring of these kind of factual essays, speculations, beginning really with Neil Ferguson's Virtual History, which I think still sets the standard in the field, and it's still, by some way, the most stimulating, the most interesting of these collections. But then there are loads of them. Andrew Roberts edits one, Robert Cowley edits three. There's a whole series of books of essays about what would have happened had Michael Portillo been Prime Minister, or Michael Heseltine, or that sort of thing. Military historians do masses of them. Armchair generals love winning battles.
Now, if these tanks had moved over just 100 metres to the left.
They love showing how they could have done better than Montgomery or Wellington.
Well, isn't that, I suppose, as you say, armchair generals or armchair historians, it allows you to, for one, show that you know enough of the facts that you can then say, if this fact hadn't have happened. Is it not just a kind of clever boy pastime?
Well, it can be, yes. So there's a collection edited by Daniel Snowman in the 80s where historians are invited to put themselves in the shoes of historical figures and imagine how they could have done better. So how they could have won battles that were lost, how could have avoided the American Revolution or the French Revolution or the American Civil War, and so on. So it struck me that this has become a fashion, and it's still going on. There are now hundreds and hundreds of these essays and not a few books. So I started off by trying to think, why is this happening? Why have we got this fashion? And of course, it's no coincidence, as we historians like to say, that it's in the 90s. It's the consequence of the collapse of communism and then the decline, the very precipitous decline of Marxism, and the end of the big narratives, the end of the idea that history has a direction. History, if it doesn't have a direction, becomes uncertain. So it's the uncertainty principle. There's also a broader crisis of the idea of progress, so that we have all sorts of things now which make us question the idea that things are constantly getting better, whether it's a credit crunch and the economic crisis, global warming, terrorism. There are many different things which put a big question mark under the idea of progress.
So this is the death rattle of the Whiggish narrative, then?
It is, yes. And it's also, I think, an outcome of postmodernism. All these things are connected, obviously, but postmodernism questions the linear narrative, questions the linear idea of time. Postmodernist architecture jumbles up all sorts of different periods. It introduces a much more subjective element into history. It places authors much more at the center of things, and I think invites us to play about with the past, a sort of playfulness about a lot of postmodernism. And so that kind of uncertainty principle, we live in an uncertain world, and a world in which I think now people are invited to speculate more about the past. So all of these things, I think, come together.
When you thought about this as a subject, and obviously your view throughout the book is, I would say, by and large, negative toward this idea of counterfactual history, or that really it doesn't teach us that much, or perhaps they're wasting their time. Did you know that that's how you would feel after ploughing through the contributions? I understand Churchill was one of the contributors in Sir John Squire's book. Did you know beforehand that you were going to decide, well, everybody, it's interesting that this has happened, but perhaps we should stick to real history?
I thought that when I first encountered the subject, but I've come to be a tiny bit more sympathetic towards it, so that I think you can divide counterfactuals into two types. There's the short run and the long run.
Right.
And I remain very sceptical about the long run counterfactuals. Right. So there are some counterfactuals, for example, which go, had Britain not entered the First World War, Germany would have won, so there would have been no Hitler, no Holocaust, and Germany would have ended up actually dominating Europe, but in a peaceful way, which is what we have in the European Union today. So it runs for a whole century. And I think there are two problems with that. One problem is that it eliminates chance and contingency altogether. Once you make the initial small change, Britain doesn't enter the First World War, then everything else follows inevitably. So it eliminates chance, ironically. Because,
rather than vaunting chance.
Yeah, counterfactualists claim, of course, that they reintroduce chance into history. But mm-hmm. actually what they do once they've made the change is the exact reverse. But once you've taken the genie of chance out of the bottle of history, then, of course, you can't put it back in again.
Why can't it happen everywhere?
Why can't there be other, there will be other changes that happen that are entirely unpredictable along the way. So extrapolating in a long run really doesn't matter. And I try and show that in the book by showing that every long run counterfactual can have at least one, and actually often many others, that are equally plausible or implausible, that are quite different. So, and that opens the way to the second problem, which is that really about 90% of these counterfactuals are examples of wishful thinking. They're not what if, they're if only. So, if only Britain hadn't fought Hitler in the Second World War, then the British Empire would have been preserved. If only Britain had not entered the common market, then we would all be much better off. If only for the French, if only Napoleon had not been defeated at Moscow in 1812, then the French counterfactualists, of course, say that France would have ruled the world and everybody would be much happier and more civilized. So it's wishful thinking is a huge element of all this.
As a historian, though, I suppose it's not hard when studying a period, when researching, to see that, yes, some small things can have a seemingly large impact, or to tell yourself that it does. I suppose, would the argument be that social and economic historians would say that it's not about kings and battles, because there were social and economic forces that would have caused these things to happen anyway, albeit in a slightly different way?
Well, yes, it's interesting that counterfactualists tend to concentrate on single great events and single great men, and it's always great men. It's a very old-fashioned view of history.
Napoleon at Waterloo.
It sees it as kings and battles. The same things crop up over and over and over again. The Spanish Armada wins and England becomes Catholic. Charles Martel is defeated and Europe becomes Islamic in the early Middle Ages. The same themes constantly. The gunpowder plot succeeds. The Archduke Franz Ferdinand is not assassinated. Now, the problem with all this, first of all, is a very narrow view of history. It's not simply that it's old-fashioned and concentrates on kings, battles, and great men. It's also that it plucks these people out of the historical context and simply sees them as absolutely free and unfettered agents. Now, you have to put, let's take Franz Ferdinand being assassinated in June 1914. He was a victim of a Serb backed terrorist organization called the Black Hand, and they had already committed various atrocities in the Balkan Wars. They were extremely violent. The chances are they would have tried some similar trick, some similar assassination, some similar outrage against the Austrians over Bosnia, which had been occupied by Austria-Hungary since 1908. I think it's completely implausible to say if the Archduke had not been assassinated, then everything would have been all right. His grandson told me that when I had lunch with him a couple of years ago on a boat on the Danube. And, of course, I said, what would have happened if your grandfather had not been assassinated? Oh, it would have been fine, of course, because he was in favour of restructuring the Austro-Hungarian Empire, would have preserved it, there would have been no First World War, everyone would be happy and so on.
So there is real wishful thinking there, obviously.
I think that is absolutely
excusably
wishful thinking.
Excusably so.
And there had already been a massive crisis in the Balkans where different countries had started to mobilise, Austria and Russia, at the end of the Balkan Wars in 1912-13, the winter. London had intervened and called a peace conference and it had all been defused. But it looks pretty likely to me that there would have been some other kind of crisis. So you have to put these events and these people in their context. And if you don't think that there are these larger forces that constrain your freedom of choice, while not eliminating it completely, of course, as Hitler did in the Second World War, who believed that willpower could conquer everything, then you're in trouble.
it seems that a lot of the counterfactual histories in the books that you've mentioned, the Ferguson collection and the Roberts collection, in terms of the British historians writing these pieces, tend to be of a particular mindset or worldview, perhaps Eurosceptic, on the right. Yes. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, it's not a particularly original observation of mine, because Jeremy Black, self-styled conservative historian, says that in his little book on counterfactuals. It seems to me a very valid point that counterfactualist historians tend to be conservative with a small C or even with a big C. And that's because the left traditionally, of course, has believed that the future belongs to them.
A better world is possible.
A better world is possible. A better world is going to happen. They're going to help bring it about, so that they don't need to speculate about alternatives, except, interestingly, about negative counterfactuals, which are a kind of minority strand in the genre. G.M. Trevelyan tried to imagine what would have happened had Napoleon won the Battle of Waterloo, and, of course, things would have gone really badly in England. You wouldn't have the triumphal Victorian liberal civilization, which he so strongly identified with. And there are a few like that, which are quite interesting. But most of them are wishful thinking of the other sort, regretting the present state of events, of state of affairs, whether it's the fact that Britain doesn't have an empire, or the fact that Britain belongs to the European Union, and imagining how things might have been otherwise. I think it's possible to do this because, again, we live in this world of all kinds of blurring between fact and fiction, where you go onto the internet and you can't be sure that the people you're communicating with are who they say they are. You go to the cinema, you watch a movie, and you can't tell now whether what you're seeing is simply computer-generated or photography of a real place or something in between or a mixture. There's a lot of this kind of uncertainty about truth. It's happening in the political world as well, where for some time now politicians have pursued policies without any regard whatsoever to the evidence for or against them. So we live in this world of where, as it were, truth and fiction have become blurred or detached from one another. And that's what really drew my attention to this whole genre. It's for an historian, I think it's very important to investigate this blurred line and see how things fall out on one side or the other.
I wondered, though, aside from the issue of whether counterfactual histories written by historians are valuable, and that's by and large what the book focuses on, are you interested at all in the fact that the cultural tropes of counterfactuality have become so strong? So it happened here, the film in 1964, thinking about what would it have been like if the Germans had invaded, the sense that, you know, the outrage that the possibility that Britons would have capitulated and collaborated. Robert Harris's novel Fatherland, 1992, huge bestseller. To what extent are those just exhibitions of the postmodernist mindset? Or do they suggest that people who've read books like Fatherland or seen films like It Happened Here or are interested in steampunk, the idea that, you know, Victorian technology had persisted into some science fiction future, so there was lots of stuff going on, but it was all made out of brass. Do you think that means that people who live in that era where these things exist or science fiction posits odd futures means that they're somehow spoilt for real history and they expect their history to trade in that sort of what happened at the grassy knoll?
There's quite a lot of counterfactual novels, of which Robert Harris's Fatherland is a really good example, imagining a Germany, it's set in Germany, in the post-war era when Germany has actually won the war. There are several novels about what things might have been like had the Germans conquered Britain. C.J. Sampson's Dominion is the most recent one. And some of these are really very good. But I think one can separate out the fiction from the history. Mm. Robert Harris really does a lot of research for his work. He's a very fine novelist, and it's no wonder his books sell very well. But he wrote Fatherland partly under the impact of the collapse of the Soviet Union. So Nazism is kind of collapsing in the book, and partly as a Eurosceptic text. It shows the as well the negative side of things had Britain not stood up to a German-dominated Europe. There is also a... I choose my words carefully, a less-than-perfect novel by Andrew Roberts called The Aachen Memorandum, where he portrays Britain dominated by the Germans. It's extremely funny, though I don't think he meant it to be funny. And, of course, in the end, the hero called Horatio rescues everything and leads a revolt against the Europeans and so on. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of novels, it's a brilliant backdrop for movies as well. Mm. There are plenty of counterfactual movies which are all very entertaining. There's this wonderful novel by Philip Roth about an America that becomes anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi or quasi-Nazi after Lindbergh, the aviator who had pro-Nazi views, is elected president. So there's a lot of that. I think it's very entertaining. But again, you can always posit alternative counterfactuals. You always find flaws. So, for example, the idea of the Germans actually winning the Second World War is not terribly plausible in the sense that that Nazism believed in perpetual struggle and perpetual warfare. And it's clear from Hitler's second book from 1928, unpublished at the time, that he intended to go on and he conquered Europe to fight against America. He believed that a people that's not constantly fighting is doomed to degeneracy. So the idea of a peaceful conquest or a peaceful post-war Nazi Europe is not really a very, very plausible one. And then, of course, there's a whole science fiction genre. There's even an annual prize called the Sidewise Prize, which is awarded the best counterfactual novel. It's from a story, short story from the 1930s, where different parallel universes with different timelines, but rather similar ones, collide, and so suddenly you get a Roman legion popping up in Colorado in 1950 and so on. There are other science fiction genres where, of time travel, for example, where the past erupts into the present or vice versa. But none of that really has to do with proper counterfactualism, which is all to do with, as I say, one small change in the timeline then leading to a series of consequences that are different from the ones we know happened.
I just wondered, however, whether the fact that as consumers of cultural products, people living now will be familiar with those time shifts, with the use of historical figures as some kind of unkillable baddie who will come back, be it Hitler or anyone else, that takes and jumbles up history, means that because we're consuming that in novels or elsewhere, it doesn't seem quite as surprising or problematic for historians to be pursuing that. In a sense, it would seem to me that they're just joining the gang. And I assume that something like It Happened Here was useful because it made great points about the British sense that they would have never done what the French had done. They would have all been freedom fighters. Mm. And it's good to consider the possibility that Brits might not have been so noble or incorruptible. So
yes,
it seems to me that I would not necessarily, before I read your book, have thought, gosh, counterfactual history is not only weak, but perhaps valueless.
Yeah, they're all, of course, all these scenarios are politically driven. So the scenario of Britain being conquered, losing the Battle of Britain, being conquered by the Nazis, and then the Brits just cravenly caving in, is part of the general national dialogue of the 70s on the decline of Britain. Correspondingly, there tend to be narratives from the 90s which show the Britons resisting furiously, which are part of a different kind of Eurosceptic narrative of Britain resisting the continent. So wherever you look, because you're not tied down by facts and evidence, there is political motivation as well as wishful thinking. I mean, there's another genre which is the kind of the warning genre, which is not really counterfactual, but it's related to it. And this begins particularly before the First World War, when there's a whole string of novels from the mid-1900s, warning what will happen if Britain does not rearm and take the German threat seriously. The best of these is William Le Queux's The War of 1910, published in 1906, that shows the Germans invading. There are so many of these that, in fact, P.G. Wodehouse satirised it in The Swoop, or How Clarence Saved England, where a dozen different armies of different countries, including one led by the Mad Mullah from North Africa, invade Britain, and nobody notices them until they start interrupting golf and cricket.
I wondered if you might like to go from people writing about things that didn't happen to people who think about things they believe have happened and have been kept from us. I'm trying to slide elegantly over to your current research, grand research project, Conspiracy and Democracy, History, Political Theory, Internet. And I understand that you and a few eminent others have been working on this project for a while, and perhaps you might like to tell us about it.
Yes, this is a Leave Hume Trust programme grant, and we're now just started our second year out of five. I'm doing it with John Norton, the internet engineer who has a weekly column in The Observer on the internet, and David Runciman, the political theorist, who's just published a book about democracy. And we have six wonderful postdoctoral research fellows in a number of different disciplines: history, philosophy, political theory, anthropology. We are looking at the relationship between conspiracies, conspiracy theories, and democracy since the French Revolution. We've got a sort of central hypothesis for testing, which is essentially when you have an authoritarian regime, a dictatorship, or as you had in the era before or immediately after the French Revolution, a very tightly controlled and limited public sphere, the only way of opposing the regime in power is to have a conspiracy. And so the governments, whether it's Stalin or Hitler or Metternich or the French monarchy for most of the 18th century, suspect the people of engaging conspiracies against them. And that's also true of the British anti-Jacobin governments during the Napoleonic and French Revolutionary Wars. But as you get the growth of a democratic public sphere where open opposition becomes possible and then legitimate, so you have the public starting to demand of governments that they are transparent, that they let the public know what they're doing. And of course, governments can never have complete transparency. There's always got to be some secrets there. And so the people start suspecting the government of engaging conspiracies against them. And now with the internet, we're looking at whether the exponential, uncontrollable expansion of the public sphere under the internet means that you have a proliferation of conspiracy theories as never before.
When most people think of conspiracy theories in contemporary life, it is things like who killed Diana and Dodi, who really killed Kennedy, and so on and so forth. Are those indicative of anything? Are they valuable? Are those the sorts of things you're looking at?
There are many different kinds of conspiracy theories, and of course they bear close resemblances to counterfactuals. They cluster around the same kind of individuals and events, and they have the same kind of blurring of fact and fiction, reality and imagination. And that's really what draws me to them, and that's a source of very great interest and puzzlement, because of course not all conspiracy theories are wrong. There are some real conspiracies that happen, and not all conspiracy theories are wrong. Famously, of course, the Watergate conspiracy, where people said, "You must be joking, the President of the United States would not authorize a break-in to the Democratic Party headquarters during an election campaign to steal incriminating evidence, or as he thought of it as incriminating, against the Democrats." But that is exactly what turned out to happen. And of course, 9/11, the destruction of the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center buildings in New York by two aeroplanes, has been the source of innumerable conspiracy theories. But one that was most important was not that Mossad, the Israeli intelligence organization, or the US government orchestrated it, but the conspiracy theory pursued by US President George W. Bush, that it is a conspiracy headed by Saddam Hussein in Iraq, which led to the invasion of Iraq, the toppling of Saddam Hussein, and hundreds of thousands of deaths, and the very difficult situation we have now. with invented evidence, weapons of mass destruction that then were never found. And the idea, of course, that Al-Qaeda were in cahoots with the very secular dictatorship of Saddam Hussein was one that strained credulity. But you penetrate deeper, and there was a real conspiracy, of course, of Al-Qaeda operatives. If a conspiracy is two or more people who get together in secret for an illegal or immoral or nefarious purpose, then there certainly was a conspiracy at the back of that.
Is the impact of this research project inevitably going to be political, do you think?
I don't see why it should come down on one political side or another, really. I hope that we'll be able to reach some kind of conclusions about whether conspiracy theories, as they're proliferating now, are a danger to democracy by undermining popular trust in political systems. And if we do, that we'll be able to try and will we be able to see why. And I'm not sure whether we want to suggest any solutions. Famously, Kaz Sunstein, who's now an advisor to President Obama, has come up with the idea that sensible people in government should have agents infiltrate groups that are perpetrating conspiracy theories and try and persuade them of the error of their ways, which is both, I think, dubious and unrealistic. So when you try and produce as well, solutions to the proliferation of conspiracy theories, I think that's very difficult. And as I say, not all conspiracy theories are wrong. There's a line of thought that says if you use the very term conspiracy theory, you're already actually trying to discredit the theorists, and we're certainly not trying to do that. Here again, as with counterfactuals, you can distinguish between different types of conspiracy theories. There's what you might call small-scale conspiracy theories, which involve a small number of people. Real conspiracies have to be small because the larger they get, the more danger there is that they'll be betrayed. And you can see those, which are sometimes correct and sometimes have evidence, from the large-scale conspiracy theories, let's say Holocaust denial, denying that 6 million Jews were deliberately murdered by the Nazis in the Second World War, which posits a worldwide conspiracy of millions of historians, journalists, the media, and so on to suppress what the deniers see as the truth, which it didn't happen.
And people who evinced those opinions were obviously already well prepared for the idea of worldwide conspiracies, presumably along with the Illuminati, the Jews, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Perhaps they were just adding on to their theories. Is it not better, though, to have a sceptical public who question, leaving aside Holocaust deniers, to have a sceptical public who say, is the British government covering up anything that happened to Diana, rather than just to say, well, they've told us that it's all fine, perhaps we shouldn't look into it.
Sure, people should always question what governments tell us. But then you have conspiracy. Some conspiracy theorists then use the word official. The official line is official knowledge. Mm. And official knowledge is produced by everyone who's paid in some sense by the governments, like university professors and researchers.
Right.
And
yes.
So by that very fact, they're regarded as being discredited. And you can have a kind of naive hyper-skepticism, which simply doesn't believe anything. And that's another extreme to people who simply accept what governments tell them, which I think in a free society like ours, for all its flaws and limitations, is not something people do. We have an active and lively media which questions the line that government gives us. And you could see that with the so-called dodgy dossier, the manufactured
45 minutes.
the manufactured set of documents which the Blair government used to try and back the theory that Saddam Hussein was a threat to world peace.
This relies, I suppose, in the main on investigative journalism and official investigative journalism, whether it's The Guardian and Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks. Is there a concern that the world of the internet, to put scare quotes around that,
moves more readily into a murky territory where the opposition between the world of journalism and the government, you know, is sort of clearly defined, that there's a certain degree of verifiability in what journalists do. But if people begin to get their information from bloggers, that this will have a negative impact ultimately.
Yes, it's a bit of both, really. So I think that's certainly true, what you're saying, because there's no filter to publish things on the internet. You don't have to give it to an editor of a newspaper or a magazine. It's not filtered through checks and controls like that. Of course, the possibility of having completely wild theories and totally unsubstantiated ideas and fantasies is much greater. But on the other hand, freedom from that sort of control does sometimes allow minority opinions and radical questioning to get through.
I wondered if you'd like to mention some of the upcoming events as part of this research project, some of the people you'll have speaking.
We've got plenty of resources, very generously supplied by the Leverhulme Trust, which we're using to have a whole series of visiting speakers and visiting lecturers in Cambridge at the Centre for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences, Humanities, or CRASH, as it's known.
Will these be open to the public?
They're open to the public. They're most Tuesday evenings, the occasional one on Monday. So we've got Deborah Lipstadt, for example, coming to talk on Monday the 5th of May at 5 o'clock on Holocaust denial. A week before that, on Tuesday, 29th of April, we've got Christopher Duggan talking with Dwight Smith about the mafia and conspiracy. We have Joseph Parent and Joseph Wyszynski from America, University of Miami, talking about American conspiracy theories, and they've analysed a huge amount of data, which they're going to share with us on the 20th of May at 5 o'clock. We've just had a series of five conspiracy movies at the Cambridge Arts Picture House, which has been a great success. Movies like All the President's Men, Rosemary's Baby, 39 Steps. And that, I think, hopefully will be repeated next year. So there's a great deal going on, and you can visit our website at www.conspiracyanddemocracy.org to find out more about what we're doing.
And if necessary, you can do it through a third-party rerouting website so that no one will know you've been there. One other reason you've been in the news recently, aside from your knighthood, congratulations.
Thank you. For
services to scholarship, is that you have been one of the historians who has countered attempts to change the history curriculum, and also more recently was described by the education minister as being someone whose view of the First World War was unpatriotic and unhelpful, perhaps. Would you care to speak to that? Were you a bit surprised when your name popped up?
I was, yes. I mean, last year, in 2013, Michael Gove produced a draft history curriculum for the years at school up to the age of 14, which was a force-fed diet of patriotic guff. And I wrote several articles arguing that students needed to be able to question and debate and discuss, not to be told what to believe, and that they needed, for the world we live in, a much broader view, not just exclusively of British history, but of world and European history as well. And it's not, I was very proud to be part of that campaign, but it's not just me. It was the historical sections of the British Academy, the Historical Association of History Teachers and Schools, the Royal Historical Society, all came out against it. And eventually it was withdrawn. And a much more sensible curriculum with much more freedom for teachers to teach what they wanted, with an element of world history and a not any longer a rigid chronological framework, which would have students learning the Middle Ages when they were very small and not coming back to them at all when they're a little bit more mature. So that was the old one went, and the new one came in. But I think Mr. Gove was rather cross with me, so he singled me out for attack as one of the leftist historians who were denigrating the British troops' bravery in the First World War by saying that they were led by lions led by donkeys.
That phrase uttered by Alan Clark, the Conservative minister.
Of course, I pointed out that it was not left-wing at all. It's Alan Clark and Max Hastings have been very, very critical of the British generals in the First World War. It's not just Blackadder. Blackadder Goes Forth, which mocks the generals, and it's certainly not left-wing. And also, of course, Neil Ferguson famously doesn't think that Britain should have entered the First World War at all. He thinks it's a complete waste of time. And it's really not right to portray the First World War as a crusade for democracy and freedom against the tyrannical Germans, which Mr. Gove and Boris Johnson both said it was, when Britain's main ally, Tsarist Russia, a despotism if ever there was one, and when 40% of British adult males did not have the vote in 1914.
So do you think he was getting his own back at you after you had had the temerity to suggest that the school's curriculum might need to prepare students for...
I suspect that, yes. Yeah. I think it's very unfortunate he didn't actually read a few history books before he said that.
Is it worrying that it appears that political motivations can have such a big impact on what is taught to school children in such an important subject as
well,
history?
Well, it is, absolutely, yes, because history is a discipline. It's built on making up your own mind about events on the basis of evidence. Mm. And that is what has been taught in schools up to now. There's been an emphasis on looking at and evaluating documents, which I think is extremely healthy, but which though critics of the old history curriculum on the right want to do away with. It's something that children enjoy. All the evidence from Ofsted reports is that the children really like the opportunity of making up their own minds on the basis of the evidence. And that, of course, educates them to be sceptical, independent-minded, critical citizens when they grow up.
I suppose some people might argue that the idea that people are insufficiently patriotic is something that starts in schools, and that it's necessary to make people proud of Britain. I just did the British citizenship test, the life in the UK test.
Did you pass?
I did.
Congratulations, Karen.
Thank you very much. It was, I took the Tory test, the test after it had been changed. The argument by the Conservatives was that the version that was started in 2007 by the Labour government was too much about rights and I guess where you could get benefits. And the Conservative version, or the version developed under the Conservative government, was more about dates. Mm. Is it a bad thing to know when the Battle of Bannockburn was? 1314, by the way. Or indeed, how many people won gold medals for Britain in the 2012 Olympics? I can't remember all of them now.
I think it's
not a good thing to know these facts?
Entirely pointless, actually. You can always look it up on Wikipedia if you want to.
If you can trust it to be correct, Richard.
More often than not, it is. But you can, yeah, it seems to be quite pointless. It's much more important to learn about rights, institutions, what it means to be a citizen. But there is, of course, a concern which is shared by the Labour Party, by Gordon Brown, that British identity needs bolstering. And it's in a very simplistic way. Politicians tend to see the foundation for a British identity in learning about the national history in a very patriotic version. If you were to ask the late lamented Tony Benn what his version would be, of course, it wouldn't be Britain's triumphs in the wars of the past. It would be the great radicals of the past. It would be the levellers and the diggers and the corresponding society in the 1790s, the English Jacobins, the Tolpuddle Martyrs, and you can construct a completely different genealogy. And both of those are beside the point. Again, what I think citizens should be encouraged to do, and that includes not just children in British schools, but also immigrants like yourself, is to think critically, join in national debates, and to have a sceptical view of the past that, of course, has a commitment to Britain, but a commitment to the free values that we all share.
We've learned recently that Michael Gove has said he quite thinks that higher education should be part of his remit. You know, it's been said that it seemed a bit surprising that someone whose background was not a historian was criticising historians such as yourself for their view of the Second World War or other things. School teachers know that he has a lot to say about how school education could be run. What's your view of what higher education under the oversight of Michael Gove would be like?
Well, of course, at the moment, universities are in biz, in the Department of Business, and that has its disadvantages. So, for example, in the research excellence framework, we've all been forced to declare our impact. Mm-hmm. And most probably that would have been less important had universities been under education. It's difficult to tell because it's treasury pressure that brings it about. But, so there are disadvantages. There are advantages. All the research councils are under BIS, and they have, by and large, been protected against really savage cuts, I think.
Yes.
And that might not have been the case under a weaker department like education. But leaving the institutional aspects aside, of course, it's instinctive to feel that since higher education is education, it ought to be in the Department for Education. And I think that's what most people felt when it was put under BIS. But now I think we're all breathing a sigh of relief.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Karen.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.